BDNG podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I am the Education Development Lead for the BDNG. I hope you enjoy listening to the BDNG podcast and find them beneficial to your practice. These podcasts are sponsored by Amaril. Amaril has no influence over the content of these podcasts. Happy listening! Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of BDNG Meets Podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I'm the Education and Development Lead for the BDNG. So today I have great pleasure of introducing Hannah Wayman, who is a consultant dermatologist and also is now an NIHR doctoral fellow at the Applied Excellence in Skin and Algae Research, also known as CESA, at the University of Bristol. So welcome, Hannah, today. And it's great to have you on board with this podcast. And I know today you will be focusing on hidradenitis suppurativa, also known as HS, which will be simplified for this podcast. So first of all, welcome. And could you just tell us how you got involved with HS and go back to the beginning?
Yeah, so how did I get involved with HS? It's such a long time ago, but I think the real starting point for me was I was working in a biologics clinic, so seeing patients with psoriasis and eczema, and the HS patients were sort of bundled in that clinic, and I felt like we were doing them a disservice. And I remember being at a lecture, I think it was one of John's lectures, where I thought, hang on a minute, we can really do this better. And I spoke to my colleagues and said, I want to take the HS patients out of this clinic and see them in a dedicated clinic. And can we try it for 6 months and just see what happens? And I guess it all just kind of went from there, really. And I've never looked back.
Oh, wow. Fabulous. And you lead the way, Hannah. I mean, I've known you for a few years now. And, you know, your passion and enthusiasm for patients with HS is quite outstanding. I know you've done an awful lot of work for us, which is fantastic. But I know you personally, and, you know, you've really changed the whole, you know, way of thinking about HS. So it's just fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. So HS, we have a lot of nurses that, you know, sometimes are looking after HS, and it's quite difficult because nurses sometimes feel, you know, we're not experts in HS, and also how do I look after an HS patient? What do I say? So could you just sort of briefly sort of describe the management of HS and possibly some of the treatments?
Of course. So firstly, thank you very much for the kind comments. And I think it's fair to say that it's certainly within the HS sort of specialist community, we work collaboratively and it's a team effort, you know, and I think it is a really lovely community where everyone works together. So thank you. But I think it's a whole group effort. How to manage HS? Well, I think first and foremost, you may say that nurses are maybe not HS specialists, but what they are fantastic at is listening to their patients and communicating with their patients. And I think that's the first and foremost thing when you see a patient with HS. They have often taken a long time to get to you. They are often quite despondent and they often feel like they're just going to get fobbed off again, let's face it. And actually, the first thing to do in that scenario is to just acknowledge the diagnosis and have that conversation with them. Say, this is not your fault. This is nothing you've done to yourself. You are not dirty. This is not infective. And it may feel kind of silly to us, but to patients that is so empowering, just to have that first statement and that first conversation before you even go down the route of how to manage it. And nurses are brilliant at that. They're better at it than we are as doctors, to be honest. And then I think the next thing is sort of almost addressing that elephant in the room, having that conversation and saying, you know, our patients are often weighed before they come in. They've often been asked whether they smoke. And I think they come in expecting you to immediately go, you need to lose some weight and you need to stop smoking. And I think the other thing is just be careful about bringing that up too soon. But equally, if they're looking tense, it's probably because they think that's what's going to happen. Time and time again, when I do work looking at how we can improve the diagnosis, patients will say, I was told to lose weight and I was sent away. And I think, you know, addressing that and maybe saying, you know, even if you say it towards the end, you know, is your weight stable? Is it changing? I'm not going to ask you to lose lots of weight, but we do know that weight is linked, but it's also the hardest thing to change. You know, those simple acknowledgements, I think, is so important.
It is. It's absolutely, it's giving that support, isn't it? And I think it is that blame culture as well. You know, I know we're short of time, the challenges of time restrictions, but, you know, having a patient wait out in the outpatient corridor or your clinic room, and then they come in and they're suddenly like, why have you weighed me? You know, it's them, you know, do you weigh everybody? And it's a really, it's a good question to ask, because it is, it's not everybody wants to be weighed. And I think psychologically already, you know, it's kind of building a bit of a barrier between, you know, the person and the person with HS as well. So there's some really good points there about, you know, supporting your patients and giving them the advice and not blaming them for smoking or weight as well. So that's fantastic. Obviously there's limited treatments for HS, and there is treatments there that probably a few of our listeners today are aware of, but could you talk through some of the treatments that we have for HS, and how do we, you know, assess a patient for the correct treatment?
Yeah, so I mean, I think treatment wise, you've got a whole spectrum of treatment, haven't you? And the thing I would say about HS treatment is about layering therapy. So it's not about putting one in, it not working, and then putting the next one in. You've got to keep layering them on top of each other to get the best control. And often the first thing that starts is antibiotics. But realistically, if you're seeing them in secondary care, they've probably already had those. So they will often have had a tetracycline, limacycline, or even rifampicin and clindamycin sometimes. The evidence for rifampicin and clindamycin is a bit mixed. A 10-week course can be helpful, but there have been some studies that have shown that a tetracycline is as effective as rifampicin and clindamycin, slightly underpowered, but still worth considering. You know, do you really want to give them this toxic stuff that turns everything orange, or do you want to think about stepping things up to a different treatment? I feel like metformin should be in the water, and I give most of my patients metformin. So metformin is a diabetic drug, but also has anti-inflammatory properties independent of those diabetic properties and independent of any effect it might have on weight. And it can work really well in some patients to reduce the inflammation. I tend to give it at a dose of 1 gram modified release twice a day, and I'll start them at once a day for a week and then increase them up to twice a day. And that can be really helpful. I tend to start that in most people when they first come to clinic. The most common reason for stopping that is tummy upset. And some of them just cannot tolerate it. So having that conversation up front that, look, if you get a tummy upset, try and bear with it, because it usually settles within a week or two. But if it's really bad, I'm not going to be upset if you stop taking this medication, and give them that ownership to stop it if they need to. Other things I would consider would be spironolactone. I use a lot of spironolactone. I tend to only use it in female patients. I think some people have tried it in males. For me, I tend to prefer it in people who have a lot of hormonal fluctuation in their HS, which we know is incredibly common. We did a survey recently, admittedly on social media, where people chose to do the survey, but about 98% said they noticed cyclical flares. So it is a definite thing. And if you can lower the flares of their HS, spironolactone is the drug to go for. And I would usually give it a dose of 100 milligrams once daily. Okay.
Brilliant.
Then what else do I do? What other things do I add in? Well, often it's then thinking, actually, does this patient need to go on a biologic agent? And I think if you're getting to the point where you've done metformin, you've done spironolactone, someone's got significant disease in front of you, actually, should you just be cracking on with a biologic agent? We know there is this window of opportunity that's well evidenced. So really, if you're thinking, hang on, should I? You probably should be starting them on a biologic agent. And it's, you know, really, if you've got someone who's got significant disease affecting more than one site, they've failed an antibiotic, particularly if they're starting to get tunneling and scarring, really you should be getting that patient onto a biologic agent so that you can halt the progression of the disease and try to prevent it going to the point where you've got permanent scarring and you're needing to think about surgery.
That's a really good point. And, you know, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because we've still got people basically cycling through antibiotic after antibiotic, and like you say, if they've not had combination therapy, you know, we're not allowed to do a biologic. If they haven't had isotretinoin, for example, which is one that you haven't mentioned there,
doesn't work. That's why I didn't mention it. It just doesn't work. I mean, I sometimes use acitretin, What I will say is most of our patients are, you know, two-thirds are women, aren't they? So acitretin, and they're usually of fertile age, so acitretin and fertility really don't go hand in hand. So that wipes out most of our patients. Yeah. And then a lot of them have mental health problems. We know that mental health problems are a comorbidity in HS. And, you know, putting someone on a drug that might make their mood even worse really isn't great. What it is useful for is people who've got a lot of follicular HS, so where they've got lots of sort of almost comedogenic HS across their back, or even in any of the affected areas, that can be quite helpful. But I will often use it as an adjunct to a biologic agent at the same time. I don't think it's all that great on its own.
Interesting. So if we've got a patient in front of us and it's a new patient coming in and they've obviously been seen in primary care, they're now in secondary, I mean, how do we look at a patient? How do we assess a patient? How do we assess their quality of life as well?
Okay, so I mean, there's tools you can use. And for us, certainly, when we see a patient in clinic, we will be doing a HISQOL, so the HS quality of life score. That is now readily available. So you can now go onto the Penn State, I think the Penn State University website, and you can just download it. It's easily available. And that's made it a lot easier to use that tool. There's still the DLQI. If you can't get the HISQOL, just use the DLQI. Use something to measure that quality of life so that you can see if things are getting worse or better. I will check mental health scores on all my patients. So I will do a PHQ-9 and a GAD-7 on everybody, because I think it's really important to understand where they are at and how they are feeling. Otherwise, the test that the screening that I tend to use more than anything else is the IHS-4, where you're looking at abscess and nodule count and tunnels. And that's quite easy to do. You know, you can make your own little table, and just we have a piece of paper that we fill in clinic. And what it means is you get that snapshot in time where you can see what's going on, and then you can see actually have things improved or have things worsened. And it's quite helpful for the patient as well to see you there counting those tunnels and working out what's going on. And then the other thing that's incredibly important, and maybe I'm slightly biased, is a pain score. So I will do a baseline pain score in every patient that I see to make sure that they can really talk about their pain as well and have that conversation. It's a starting point, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we're definitely more aware of pain now, aren't we? And I think, you know, a lot more people are talking about pain, and probably a lot of that is to do with the pain study that I know you've instigated. Could you just talk about the pain study and what's been happening there?
Sure. So, I mean, it came from the fact that there really isn't much evidence to support what pain relief we give our patients with HS. And we as dermatologists with limited pain knowledge were thinking, actually, hang on, should we be giving neuropathic painkillers, for example, so the amitriptylines of this world? Or should we be thinking about something else? Where do we go with this? How do we support our patients? Lauren Orenstein in the United States has done a lot of work with pain and continues to do a lot of work with pain and has supported this study. And she has written a paper looking at how you manage pain, but it's taken from post-herpetic neuralgia, which isn't the same condition. So yes, you can sort of extrapolate, but equally, can you? You know, and you're working out where you go with this. And what we're doing within the pain study is the first part is really understanding how patients, GPs, dermatologists, particularly those with an interest in HS, pain specialists, how they all think pain should be managed and how it is managed currently in their practice. So that was through a survey. And then we're planning some focus groups in the next few weeks to actually discuss and get down to the nitty gritty of some of the things that have come out of those surveys. And it's been fascinating, you know, the way we particularly ask patients, you know, how do you self-manage your pain? And what do you do personally at home? You know, some of them will take things like cannabis, some of them will self-lance areas, a lot of them will use Vicks vapor rub to bring things to a head. And we don't know, we can't say that doesn't work unless we've really thought about it and gone through it. And I think, you know, this is going out to the BDNG, isn't it? And I think nurses often will have those conversations with patients about how do you manage your pain. And sometimes patients will open up more to you than they will to us as dermatologists, you know. And I think making them aware that it's okay to tell us the stuff that maybe isn't prescribed can make life a lot, you know, it's more open for everybody. Everybody can work out how bad the disease is. You know, if someone is self-lancing a boil every week, that disease is not controlled, but we want them to be able to have those conversations about that.
It is. It's really important, isn't it? Because, you know, as a clinician, I've definitely come across a basically all what you've mentioned there, you know, about self-lancing and, you know, maybe taking other substances as well. And, you know, in a way you can understand as well. I mean, not understand totally, but you understand why they're doing this, because mm-hmm. they reach their limit and it's desperation, isn't it, really? If, you know,
it is. And I think for us, it's about, you know, really, you know, we need to listen to our patients and we need yeah. to understand. And I think one of the things that has come out of this work, so I've worked with the British Pain Society, and what has come out of this is this ethos of living well with chronic yeah. pain. And it isn't just about one drug that's going to make things significantly better. It's about a whole host of things. It's about psychological support. It's about gentle exercise that works for a patient with HS. So this project has become much bigger than perhaps we first anticipated when we started it. And the hope is that once we've brought together the survey results and these focus groups, that we can do what's called a Delphi process, where we send out sort of a list of things that we think might be important in managing pain. And we send that out to a set group of experts and then try and really get down to the nitty-gritty of what is really important in how we manage pain, with the idea that we can ultimately make a guideline that can help to support people.
A guideline would be fantastic, because I think that's where the struggle is, isn't it? When you know, we've got a patient in a lot of pain, where do we go? You know, if we don't necessarily have the secure links with the pain teams, you know, it's what do we do? And it's yeah. it can be quite tricky, very tricky as well. And also, you mentioned there about assessing pain very quickly. I mean, how do you assess pain for when a patient comes in? Do you do it a score out of a certain yeah. number, or is that how you do
so
it?
We do a numerical rating scale. You can also do a picture, you know, the one with the smiley faces as well. You can do that one. I think the important thing, though, to bear in mind is that patients' pain fluctuates because they have flares. And I think a really important thing to think about is your flare management with patients, because it's all well and good saying, I'm going to put you on this treatment to help control your HS, but HS still flares, and they need somewhere to go when their condition flares, because that's when they panic. You know, when their disease flares, they're already on their treatment and they think, well, what do I do next? And it's even simple things like having that conversation about, right, you're taking paracetamol twice a day. In your flare, up that paracetamol to the standard four times a day. You know, so they know where they've got to go, and have those conversations with the patients before they're in a flare, when they're much more able to think about, actually, how would I manage this pain? Would having a warm bath, for example, be something that I would find helpful if I had a flare? So that they know what to do when they're not in a flare, and then they've got that written. I know some patients will stick it on their fridge, for example, so that it's always there, or inside the medicine cabinet, so they know where they can go if they have a flare.
And I think, like you say there, it's really important sometimes to reflect back on the patient, isn't it? Because I always think, well, they're the expert as well, because it's very much, you know, sometimes directed by the patient, how they, you know, control their pain in a way, like you mentioned, hot baths, warm baths there. And I think sometimes you learn from the patient as well. And it's always good. I always mention the word journey. So we go on this journey together.
Yes.
And it's not me telling you what to do. It's basically having that conversation mm-hmm. Together, really, isn't it? It's really important.
Not done to you, but done with you. And I think that's
absolutely
the thing. And it's, you know, if the patient doesn't think a treatment option is going to work, then it probably won't work. And being able to yeah. work with them and support with them and say, you know, where do you want to go with it? Go from here. Do you think your disease is well enough controlled at the moment, or do you think we can do better? Is a question I will often have with them each time they come to clinic, so that we can really get a feel of where we're both heading.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking about this, challenges is a word that I'm going to bring up. We have got challenges, and I think, you know, we've quite often maybe, like we say, we have patients coming in, you know, experience a lot of pain, experiencing a lot of flare, you know, it's unsightly for them, they're not going out, they're not having a social life, and they maybe not got a partner, you know, we've got all these factors going in, and then we've still got people sort of saying, right, let's do another course of antibiotics, let's do this, let's do that. And you can see the patient's face drop. And I mean, how do we get around that, as, you know, as nurses? How do we face these challenges? And how do we potentially, like you say, when we feel that a patient is due a biologic, how do we say that strongly?
I think it's about breaking down barriers. as much as anything else. And maybe that's a bit of a cop out, but I think, you know, we've done a survey recently where we've asked people about how they manage HS, and, you know, we've asked sort of GPs and said, you know, how do you manage it? How do you manage the pain? So when we did the pain bit, we asked them, how do you manage pain? And the number of responses I got back that said, well, it's just the infection. If you treat the infection, it will get better. So we've got a long way to go. We've got a lot more to teach people, to support them. So I think it is about questioning it, standing up there and saying, well, hang on a minute, this is not an infective disease. This is an inflammatory disease. What is the merit in giving these antibiotics? And why are we not giving the biologic when we know that the earlier we start it, the less scarring there is? There is no reason why a nurse cannot stand up to a dermatologist or whoever and say, look, hang on a minute, this is what the evidence shows. This is where we need to go with it. And if they don't feel like that decision can be made in their district general or in their hospital, then what we are setting up is a national MDT. So they can bring those cases along to the national MDT and discuss the cases. And we'll always have some HS experts there, some we'll have pharmacists, psychologists and surgeons, so that you can hear the different options available to you. And we can talk through the cases and help you, to support you with that. And if you want to do that, just drop me an email and we will add you on to that mailing list, and then you can submit cases and we can discuss them.
This is really exciting, and this is something I'm involved with as well, is the national MDT, which is really fantastic, because like you say, it does give people confidence. And I think, you know, they can also relate to maybe one of their patients as well. And, you know, like you say, the evidence will be discussed, you're working with you know, leading people in the HS field as well. So it's really, really exciting for our listeners today as well. If that's something that you did want to be involved with, you can either get in touch with the BDNG, or we will provide Hannah's email as well, very kindly. And also you can also get in touch with myself as well. So I'm more than happy to put you in the right direction for that as well. So that's in the future, the national MDT. So we're just talking a little bit about what we have available now. We've mentioned that you've done the pain study, and we've talked a lot about pain. We've talked a lot about management as well. We've talked about some of the barriers, you know, and these patients are faced with, you know, even 7 or 10 years before they actually get a correct diagnosis. So I'm going to go back again to the very, you know, start of things. How do we promote earlier diagnoses, which is probably going to be more in primary care, would you think? How do we get around that?
So this is the whole crux of my PhD. So we haven't solved the problem yet, but maybe we will in the future.
We will indeed.
So my background is as a GP. I was a GP, a practicing GP for 6 years before I moved to dermatology. So that is why a lot of my research focuses at primary secondary care interface and how we can improve it. And the same story comes back here. It's not being done to them, it's being done with them. So we need to get the GPs on board to help us improve the way we support patients. So we're doing various things. We're trying to really understand what those barriers are to making the diagnosis, and also what facilitates a diagnosis. Now, a lot of this work has been done, but in the United States, where the healthcare system, and in Denmark, and in there, the healthcare system is very different. So we can't necessarily assume that the same thing is happening in the UK. So what's going wrong is the first question. And then how can we improve it? And I think that is challenging. You know, how can we improve it? Because how can we support GPs to make that diagnosis earlier? Our hope is that through my research, we will be able to develop a tool that will support GPs. But that's easier said than done. GPs have a lot of work to do, and they are really strapped. So you can make a tool, but if you can't support GPs, you know, can't help that tool to be used in clinical practice, it's no good. So a lot of the work that will happen after that is actually, how do we bring this into the system, and how do we really support people to do that? And in the meantime, it's about things like this. It's about doing education to support people, to help these conversations be had so that we can take things forward.
It's really exciting. I think, you know, a few years ago, and, you know, you'll know as well, Hannah, we went to conferences and HS was never mentioned, whereas now it's definitely, you know, it's up there and talked about, and people talk about it, and we have lectures on it, we have presentations, we have specialists as well in HS, which we never had just even a few years ago, which is great. So I think, you know, leading the way again, and I think probably you will do a lot of this, Hannah, is the primary care sector. And, you know, getting that diagnosis a lot earlier, which will help our patients greatly. And it is a lot of education, isn't it? So basically, again, we're just going to go and talk through, you know, you've talked through some of the sort of medical treatments. And I know there's, you know, we're advancing now in our biologic treatments as well, which is very exciting. And I think, you know, our listeners today, I'll definitely know about some of the biologic treatments that are out there and how to support their patients. Can we just ask about surgery as well? I mean, how that fits into HS?
So I think surgery in HS is really quite exciting, actually, because it works really well in conjunction with the biologic therapies. So certainly in Bristol, we will have a patient on a biologic, let's say adalimumab, and we will do deroofing at the same time. So deroofing is where you take the top bit, like it sounds, take the roof off, clean it out, and let it heal from the bottom up. The best thing about it is it's done under local anaesthetic. It's fairly quick to heal. Often within 2 to 3 weeks, the area is healed. And most patients, they did a survey in the States. So Chris Syad does a lot of the surgical HS research. And he showed that actually most patients felt that the pain from the surgery was less than an HS flare. So that gives you an idea of where you're going with it. And it heals really quickly. Patients do really well. They come back for more, which I think speaks for itself. And it can just be a really great option for these patients, particularly if they've got a problematic area. You can remove that area. Yes, they might get HS elsewhere, but at least that one area is no longer causing them bother, and they can get their movement back and things can improve. So I think it's a phenomenal resource that we have available to us, and it's so easy to do. I don't think people should be afraid of doing deroofing. They can always come and watch. They can come to Bristol and watch. There's other centres across the country that are doing it, and we're all very willing for people to come and watch it so that they can then bring it back to their own departments and start doing it. But I am certainly not a surgeon, but I can do deroofing, and I love doing deroofing, and I love seeing the results of my patients and the improvement that they've got from it.
Yeah, the results are quite phenomenal sometimes, aren't they? And, you know, you do get patients coming in asking, oh, I need surgery, or, you know, can you refer me for surgery, Tina? It happens, doesn't it? Mm. And quite often they'll be showing you the after surgery as well, and, you know, how well they've done. Oh, this is great, I can move my arm, or, you know, I can walk better. So yeah, I'm not going to talk about dressings because it's a big subject. And also the fact is that we have got some experts in the background that we've done other podcasts with. You know, about the dressings. So if anyone's listening today wanting to know about dressings, then please listen to our other podcasts on the BDNG. That would be fantastic. We've talked, as I say, about the treatments, surgery, and I'm going to move on a little bit now. I know we've also had John Ingram talking about this, but it's the new exciting registry as well for HS. So can you briefly just talk about that, Hannah?
Yeah, so that's coming, which is really exciting and very much John's piece of work. And I think what I would say about that is it's exciting because it's going to be akin to Bad Beer and A-Star, and we're going to have a wealth of information that we can use to try and answer some of these questions that up till now we've had limited evidence or a few case series or data sets. And actually what we need is more. And the idea behind this registry is that we will really be able to answer some of those nitty gritty questions. There's also going to be a biobank, so we'll get some more genomics that will help us to answer some questions in the future that might help us guide therapy, which is super exciting. So I think the key thing at the moment is getting it started. And I know John's working incredibly hard to get it started, but hopefully we'll be rolling it out soon, and then we can really start answering some of these questions and looking at the evidence and the yeah, it's exciting.
It is. I know, I must admit, I was, even when I found out about it initially with John, it's very exciting because I know the valuable work that we get from Bad Beer and also A-Star as well. So, you know, to have an HS dedicated registry is phenomenal. And also just to say to patients, you know, for us to take an interest in patients and say, look, we've got a lot of specialty people behind the scenes working away on HS, it just gives them hope, and it just gives them that support as well, which is fantastic.
I think you're right. I think that's really important. And I think the other thing is there are so many exciting trials coming through in HS as well. I know Brian will talk to you more about new therapies, but I think it's worth thinking about, you know, if you're in a centre with a reasonable number of HS patients, actually, can you do a commercial trial to give these patients more options? And certainly that can be incredibly helpful and empowering for the patients. You know, they all say, I really want to do this because I want to help other people with HS. And I mean, you've heard it, haven't you, Tina? They yes. will all say it. And actually, it's amazing how many I have, I struggle to get all the patients that want to do the trials in to do the trials, you know. And I think it's a really important thing and a way we can help, you know, how everyone can help sort of on the ground in dermatology to really help to increase the spectrum of medications we have available to us.
Absolutely. And it's just amazing when you see that patient, just the relief on their faces, isn't it? Just to have some hope, have the support, have somebody recognising their condition and actually what it is as well. You know, we all get the patients in that have had HS for years and years and years, and they were diagnosed 2 years ago. You know, it's just... things are changing, definitely changing, which
you
is
can see why they come in with their backup, can't you? They come in because they're expecting another fob off, and it's just breaking down those barriers as effectively Excellent. As you can, really, so that you can move forward and give them the best possible care.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, that's really, you know, we're talking about, you know, these patients getting fobbed off. You've seen an awful lot more HS specialist clinics, which is fantastic, and also some really good nurse-led ones as well, which is really, really positive. So again, if anyone wants any information on, you know, specific tools to use for HS specific clinics, then again, you can get in touch with the BDNG or Hannah. I will get in touch with Hannah around that if needed, so she's not inundated when she's doing a PhD with all these questions. So please, if you're need any more information on this, then get in touch with myself. That would be fantastic. So yeah, I think I could speak to you all day, Hannah. As you know, I am so passionate as well about HS, and I just love looking after the HS patients and, you know, how it's changed over the last couple of years. We've done a lot of work with the BDNG with HS, and we're really trying to drive the support and care forward as well. So I'd like to thank our listeners as well very much for contributing to all the HS care and support that is being provided now. And just the excitement, isn't it, Hannah? Just the excitement over HS as well. Is there any final sort of key words you'd like to say, Hannah, or do you need to promote anything that you, I know you do a lot of work on HS, is there anything else you would like to promote at the moment before we finish this podcast?
I don't think there's anything particularly. I think one thing that we would like to promote, actually, she says there's nothing, and then I change my mind. We are doing a survey at the moment on the management of HS, and it has gone out through the BDNG, but we would love more responses. And perhaps, Tina, we could put the link to the survey under the podcast so that people could do it. So this survey is to understand how you manage HS. We're not judging anyone. We want to open up the channels so that we can understand the challenges there are to access to the medication, so that we can have conversations on a more national level to allow more uniformity across what's available. So that would be amazing. So I will publicise that. But if I can end on one thing, it would be just remember that it's about supporting those patients when they come in that first time. Just give them time to talk. Don't try and cover everything. You know, you can't cover every comorbidity, all the treatment options and everything in that appointment. They will be so relieved to be with somebody who understands this condition and who is willing to listen, that you can start with small steps and build up. You know, you can start a couple of treatments and then take things forward. But equally, don't be afraid to see someone at that first appointment and think, actually, this patient's already had multiple antibiotics, I need to put them on adalimumab. That's okay, as long as you can explain that and justify that to the patient.
Fabulous. And it's really good words of support there for the nurses that are seeing these patients, the HS patients, and giving them the confidence, which is what you've done with this podcast, Hannah. You've really given lots of good information out, and we've cycled through a lot of topics there, but you know, it's all really, really valuable for nurses. And also just thank you for, you know, being so supportive of nurses, what they can actually achieve in their consultations. You don't have to be an expert in HS. You can literally give these patients the support and the recognition that they actually deserve. And I think podcasts like this really, truly help the listeners today, but also all the patients out there as well. So I'd like to say a massive, massive, massive thank you, Hannah, to for what you do. You do so much work on this topic, and as I say, I've learned so much over the years from you, and gained your passion in HS purely because the enthusiasm you show as well, which is so positive. So thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you for having me.
An absolute pleasure as always. And as I say, what we will do is put a couple of links into the end of this podcast. We will try, if you can, to do the management survey that's out there. It's really quite straightforward. It really doesn't take too long at all. I've done it myself, and it gives really good insight into all the medications that we've mentioned in this podcast, really, as well. And
it's closing soon.
So we'd
love you to do it as soon as possible, please.
Perfect. Promote it now while we can. And yes, and if anyone does want any details on the HS National MDT meeting as well, please get in touch with myself through the BDNG. And as I say, if anyone's setting up HS clinics as well, again, you can get in touch with myself, and I can always reach out to Hannah if needed. So we will end, but thank you once again, Hannah.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For further information on the BDNG, visit our website bdng.org.uk and watch out for the next BDNG podcast, which is coming soon.